Hey guys, I'm your host Adam McCabe and welcome to the Gay Footballers Podcast. I hope you guys are having a fantastic week and thank you so much for joining the show. So just a quick recap, the Gay Footballers Podcast is the podcast with the goal to spread the awareness of LGBTQ and ally representation in sports, with the main focus being on soccer, or some people call it football. I'll also explore some other sports and personalities, with each episode consisting of a 30 to 45 minute, maybe an hour, interview with an individual who's making an impact in their sporting discipline. This person can be a current or former athlete, a member of an organization's front office, a sports journalist, whatever they may be. But in each interview, we're going to uncover the challenges, opportunities, and successes that this individual has and faces every day within their discipline of sport. To my first-time listeners, thank you so much for coming out and giving this podcast a try. I really hope you enjoy it, and I hope you keep on coming back. For my returning listeners, I cannot thank you so much for what you do week in and week out. This podcast would not be what it is and would not be at the place that it's at without you guys. So again, thank you so much for your help and support. For this week's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Luke Tufts, who is an openly gay coach living in the United Kingdom. This is an episode I've been holding on for a while, I have to admit. Luke and I spoke at a conference in London, the Just a Ball Game Stronger Than conference back in February at Wembley Stadium. Luke was a part of the morning panel, and I was a part of the afternoon panel. So when I did this interview with Luke, he was coaching for Hartley Whitney FC. Since February and since this interview, he has now moved on to coach another team called Knaphill FC, and Luke's doing a fantastic job with the club. He did an amazing job with his previous club. He's having quite a bit of success with this club. But just a bit of an update I'll have in the podcast. He's not currently with Hartley Whitney FC anymore. Anyways, Luke's super energetic, very passionate. I can see why his players love to play for him. He's got a great buzz, great energy about him. And you can tell in the podcast, we kind of go back and forth. We argue about a few things, but that's the nature of, I think, being competitive and being a part of sports. But again, Luke's done quite a few podcasts, and he's very open about saying, you know, hey, I'm a coach that just happens to be gay, and I don't want people to think of me as the gay coach. I'm just a football coach, and it just happens that I'm gay. And he's really big about, like, focus on my results and what I do as a coach and not, you know, who I am sexually attracted to. And I love that about Luke, that he's super football driven and football focused. And I really think you guys will like this podcast. He's a great guy. So without further commentary, I'd like to introduce you guys to Luke Tufts. Enjoy. Luke, I want to thank you for joining me. I know you were just on an afternoon or a morning panel here at the Stronger Together event at Wembley Stadium, and I'm glad I caught you before you left.
No problem. Thank you very much.
So would you go ahead and tell the listeners, I mean, who you are, what team you're coaching here in the UK, and just a little about yourself.
Okay, so my name's Luke Tufts. I'm the first team head coach at Hartley Whitney FC. So we're in the Evo Stick Premier, one league below the Conference South. So we're a semi-professional football club. I also manage our under-18s, work with our junior set-up, and my day job is I'm the academy manager as well at Pulse Premier Football, which works closely together.
That sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. It's about an 80-hour week, I think, yeah. But I absolutely love it, so it's easy to get up in the morning still, even after a long day.
So, and because in the States we really only have four divisions, can you explain kind of where in the pyramid?
I imagine we would be the one below your MLS.
Okay.
Would be about the level we're at.
And in the UK, it's...
We're in the seventh tier.
Seventh tier, okay.
Seventh tier.
So, for those listeners, there are, I think, I don't even know, like 12, 13, I don't know, 20 tiers in England?
There are thousands of leagues, but we have the English football pyramid. And so the top five is just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So Premiership, Championship, League 1, League 2, Conference. Then it breaks into two, Conference North and South. And then we're the one below that where it breaks into 3 or 4 different areas. And from there, every level you go down, it doubles the numbers and that. So we're 3 promotions off the Football League, off League 2.
So let me ask, how's the season going thus far?
I think we've done well. We started really well, actually. We were top of the league after 5 or 6 games. It's our first season at this level. We got promoted last year. And I think teams started to... We rode the crest of a wave early doors. We had a bit of a winning mentality. Winning is an easy wave to ride on, to be honest. And then after a couple of defeats and that, I think we kind of petered out and we found where we are. We've had to change how we play a little bit, which is quite interesting. But we've got our philosophy, it does work. We're up against it a little bit, although you should never really look at this sort of thing, but our budget is much smaller than other teams in our league. We've been promoted 2 years in a row. So we took over, 4 years ago. And our first year we won the Cornwall Counties Premier, which was the first time the club had won it since 1979. I think it was 79. But we couldn't go up because our ground wasn't big enough. We needed a new stand, we needed new this, we needed new that. So the club did all that for us. And we won the league again the next year. We managed to keep a very good group of players together, which we were very fortunate for. And we went up. And then last year we got promoted to the Southern League First Division. And I think our aim, we wanted to stay up, but halfway up we'd have been happy. But we won the playoff final and we beat Cambridge City in the final, which was fantastic, and got promoted to the Evo Stick Premier, which is the first time in the club's history.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Well, we're very lucky. We got a fantastic group, to be fair, on and off the pitch. So we're very fortunate.
So, I mean, I know a bit of your journey to becoming a manager, but can you share, you know, that journey? And I mean,
I'm coach, not I manage the academy, coach the first team.
Coach, excuse me. But I mean, was it always you had this vision of doing this, or was it football first and you kind of...
Yeah, I don't think any 8, 9-year-old growing up thinks, oh, I want to be a coach or I want to be a manager. They obviously just want to play. I love football from when I was very young. I played every single week, played for a team from when I was 7 years old throughout. When I was like 15, 16 years old, a lot of my mates were quite good and were starting getting picked up by clubs. I felt a bit left out. So I rung all the local semi-professional clubs. And Camberley Town Football Club, one of the local ones, actually got back to me, invited me down to training. I went down there. I was nowhere near good enough whatsoever, but they felt sorry for me, I think, kept me about. And I was there for a few years in and around it. And my old boss said, look, Tufts, you're the worst player I've ever seen, but you've got a brain. Do you want to be my assistant? And I jumped at the chance and I worked my way up. And then a few years later, I've got my B licence, got my FAU for Warden. Yeah, and I'm full time in the game. Very lucky.
And I really want to credit you. So I have my level 2 FA licence that I did when I was over here. And I mean, it's tough. It's no joke. It's not something you do on the weekend and easy peasy, you're a coach. I mean, those courses are pretty tough, and the fact that you've gone that high is...
Oh, I love them though. Yeah. I love the technical detail in them. Buzz off it. Did my B licence. It took me a year to do that. I'm trying to get my A now, which will be even longer than that. But no, it teaches you the game. So like your level 1 is just for little kids, like games, and it's just on the ball. Your level 2, I'm guessing what you did was like on the ball and around the ball. So you looked at when to run with the ball, when to dribble, short passing, long range passing, 4v4s, I guess you got to. Go up to your B licence, and it's on the ball, around the ball, and away from the ball. So how can we affect play away from the ball, which is, again, a lot more exciting and actually helped us with a lot of things we did. You start to look at triggers of when to press, when to jot, when to show inside, when to show out, dealing with crosses, and so on, so on. And you go up to your A licence, and I was very lucky to go and observe a block of the A licence in the summer. Then you're looking at the 11v11 game, which obviously I managed to do it because of experience, but obviously you learn a lot more technical detail in the course. They're like, what was it? It was a whole block on a high press. It was fantastic looking at traps, looking at jumps, and looking at how teams stop playing out in the first place, or do you want to stop them playing out? Because if they're playing out, they're in front of their goal, that's where you want them, surely. So it's quite interesting. There's a lot of detail on that to go into. So, no, buzz off coaching matches.
I mean, just hearing you right now and looking at you explain all that, I remember earlier when you were speaking in the panel, and I was sitting there and I was thinking, man,
I can see and feel the enthusiasm and buzz that you get from coaching. I was like, that's the kind of coach, you know, I want to play for or play under. That's the kind of teacher I want, is someone who is so enthusiastic. And just for the listeners, I mean, I can see it here. You're talking about it. You're just so enthusiastic. And I think that's part of being a great coach. And a great trainer is you motivate someone to get better and to do better. And I can, as I can see here, you obviously do have a brain for the game.
Oh, learn. I was going to say that Hartley, we've been successful, but I'm such a small cog in what is a massive machine. So we've got, as a collective, we've got a fantastic management team. We've got a fantastic player group, which we've held together and love the club. And a lot, I think part of it is they like the management team, and that's a part of it, is we've got a fantastic football club. They're lovely people and we're very well looked after. They do everything properly and we want for nothing. I know it sounds like really stupid, but like every year we've gone up, they've more than done what we need to do. And I know it sounds silly, but like the dressing room's got more professional as we've gone up. And although our banter's probably the same and the way we do things is very similar, because I always thought we were quite professional even when we were in the Combined Counties, the little things a club does, like we have different sort of drinks before the game, during, we get like hydration drinks after the game, like your Zoos and that, little things, but it does make a difference. And the bar, it's always welcoming, and got a really, really good support base. Like where we've come from, I think our first year our average attendance was 65. Now we regularly get 300 people is about our average, which is amazing. So it's a great place to be.
Can you talk about your own kind of, if you had your team? I mean, I know you work with the youth team. So I guess, what's your style? What do you like to do with your teams? Are you
whatever you're talking about? Because it's very different.
Well, let's say with the
talking about first team.
Let's talk first team.
First team.
Yeah.
It depends what's your player group like. So, firstly, have you got the best team in the league? Or are you up against it? Or are you in a relegation battle? Are you looking for promotion? It's very different.
Yep.
Overall, I'm more direct, I think, than you probably find most are. So I know the fashion, what people seem to do is they seem to look at what's happening in the Premier League or La Liga, and they think that's a good idea, they're doing it, let's mirror it, because that's obviously right, cause that's what they're doing. Well, no, you don't train full time, you don't have those players, that's not necessarily relevant for you. So, excuse me. So, for our first few years, our success, we were very counter-attacking. And we said, second, there's no pressure on the ball. If we can't affect it first phase, so if we can't affect their first touch, you can have the ball, we're going to drop to the halfway line. And we're going to deny that space in behind. So, lower down, for those of you, I guess a lot of your listeners are in America, in our non-league football, your pitches aren't always the best, although sometimes they are. Your touches aren't always there. And a lot of teams, they're direct, they're clipping channels. So the danger is always in behind. The danger's in front of your goal. So if you can drop and deny that space, suddenly you're not in a foot race. They've now got to play in front of you. And then when you say, right, you can't defend the whole pitch, and we say, right, this is a bit of the pitch we're going to defend. And then you all go back to the halfway line, is what we did. And we said, we're not going to press until they come over the halfway line. So we used to do, so we'd be 4-4-2 in, 4-5-1 out. We'd shut line, show them one way, and then we go and press in a small area. Because you're deep, encourages teams to come on. We nick the ball, we've got space in behind, and then we just counter quick players. So that's what we used to do. We've evolved very much this year. The higher up you go, we found the higher up you go, teams, the second your head's up, they know you're going in behind, so they drop and you don't see the ball again for 10 minutes. So we've had to slightly evolve. We play a lot more than we used to. I think you can almost overplay. I think some teams do overplay in non-league football. Like I said, one mistake in front of your goal is great, but one mistake, they're in front of you going and having a shot off. And if you think about how, if you're trying to play football and keep possession, your centre halves are split, your full backs are high and wide, your centre midfielders will be in the centre circle, strikers in their half to make the game big. Fantastic. If you make one mistake, their players just got run through the middle of the pitch, there's no one there, they scored. So yeah, there's a little bit more to it to think about than let's just play beautiful football for the sake of it. Where are we going to play football? How are we going to play football? How are we going to affect it if it goes wrong? Because football, it's basically an invasion sport, isn't it? How can we invade their goal whilst through organisation protects our own? And you've got to always think about the second.
So what changes then when you're working with the youth teams? Are you focused more on technical? Like, let's make sure you have, we're working on your technique at this age. And as you were rightly describing, tactical is so much more of a focus on the first team. I mean, when you're with your youth players, what's the style, or not even the style, but how is your approach as a coach?
How old, what level? There's so many variables.
Yeah. So, I mean, what Are you over every single... What teams are you with?
I manage our under-18s.
Okay.
I work with our under-18s Sunday. I work with the academy, which is full-time, so we've got three teams there. And I do... I coach two under-8s, two under-10s, the 13s, the 14s, help with the 15s.
I mean, so that's so much.
Yeah, it is a lot.
This
is the last year of doing this much, though. Like I said, I've asked the youth team. Someone else has got to do it next year. I've said that last 3 years in a row, but this
that's,
has to be
But that's
got to
be difficult. Because, like, as you're saying, what you're teaching someone at U8 is totally different from what you're teaching someone
that's,
at
that's
U18.
That's the fun. It's all the same. It's boring.
Yeah,
it's because it's so different. So, now, this is a real problem we have in this country. And America. By the way, I worked in America, and you're as bad at it as we are. Is it has to be about winning. Win, win, win. Right, now, football does have to be winning. There's always a winner. There's always a loser. But you've got to think at a young age, if you're winning, it means you're good at something. So if you're good at something, you're obviously not trying something new, because otherwise you wouldn't be succeeding all the time. So how much are you actually learning? How much are you actually developing? So what we started doing in this country now is we're saying you can't post results to your 13s, I think it is, or might be 12s.
Oh, wow.
It's all hidden away. And it's quite right, because everyone on the side... Let's look at it, under-8s game. You go up to the park on a Sunday, under-8s game, and you see the ball go near your penalty area. You suddenly hear all the parents are like, ah, get it out, get it out, which is great. Little Timmy now panics, launches it down the other end of the field. How many touches of the ball has he had? What's he learned? You missed out all the midfielders, by the way. And now you're in front of their goal, and everyone's applauding, screaming, clapping, yeah, well done, and as you get a shot off. So how much are you actually developing there? And it quite simply becomes the biggest and the strongest succeed early doors, and the smaller ones get no touches, don't really progress, and you're probably stunting their development. So what I try and do for our younger age groups, it's very ball-centric. It's all ball manipulation. So we do different topics, so 6-week cycle. So our first cycle is dribbling and... when to dribble, firstly it's dribbling and ball manipulation. Then we look at when to dribble, when to run with the ball, yada, yada, and move on. So, but we had a lot of problem with the parents, because... the kids were just dribbling and doing loads of skills and tricks, losing the ball and getting battered. And I was saying, it doesn't matter. Who cares? They're 8 years old. They're having touch of the ball and they're succeeding. Like, we'd go up a game on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, get a hat, all the tricks that we've learned in training in the hat, they have to pick out one each, including the goalkeeper, by the way. They have to do that trick in a game. And the win isn't the score. The win is them doing a trick under pressure in front of people. Now, that's a real win. And the more you do that, the more comfortable you are with the ball. And if you keep doing that sort of thing, by the time you're 10, 11 years old, they can now start, their vision opens up. Because at 8 years old, their vision isn't like ours. They get tunnel vision. All they can see is what's in front of them. That's why everyone says, oh, I've got to spread out, spread out. They can't spread out. Not, some of them might. There were really advanced ones in that. The average 8-year-old child cannot see anything outside their view. Also, let's look at an 8-year-old child. What? They're selfish. It's my ball. Why do I want to pass it to him? This is my ball. So use that to your advantage. Just have touches, improve them. And as they evolve cognitively as well as technically, then you can start when to pass, when to dribble, when you can start working on all these things. And it progresses. By the time they're 10 years old, 11 years old, level 2 stuff that you spoke about starts coming out on the ball, around the ball, because their vision's open. Start looking at passing and things like that. Obviously, you cover these things as an 8-year-old, but realistically, if you do it any more than in 2s, 3s, 4s and that, it's going to be quite tough. Unless you work at an academy. Academy, they're cognitively ahead of the average kid. That's why they're there. But I'm talking about grassroots. And then when they hit 12, 13, 14, then you can start exploring on the ball, around the ball, away from the ball, and start teaching them a few roles and responsibilities. And when they, you talk about winning, and that winning starts becoming important when they're about 16 years old. And our under-18s are taught to win. But we've actually got a very young under-18 side, where most of our boys are 15 this year. So we struggle, but that's entirely because of physicality.
Yeah.
But that's where gamesmanship, we start teaching them.
So you talked about it a bit earlier, and I want to talk about this more in depth. So you went over to the US and you did some coaching over there. And I know of a few programs that they bring in coaches from the UK who maybe want to see America or experience that, but also develop their coaching skills. So can you talk about that experience coming over to the US and coaching?
Oh, it was amazing. So I went, it was 2013. I went for a job with UK Elite Soccer, it was. And I somehow beat X amount of applicants to get a job there. It was unbelievable. No idea how that happened. I must have bought someone off, but can't remember. Got a job out there, and I was based, so my first week there, I'd actually passed my driving test the day before. I'd never driven on my own in my life, and all of a sudden I'm driving on the other side of the road in another country. We had a week sort of like getting used to the country in New Jersey, which is where they were based. And then they gave us a car and said, right, Tufts, you're off to live in Columbia, which is a town in Maryland near Baltimore. So we drove down the East Coast to there. And then we did lots of coaching. So effectively worked for the company and they hire us out to different teams or different age groups or like different groups. And we'd do all sorts of things. It was quite a diverse job. So we'd have work with 4 or 5 year olds in the morning, like their petite games, petite age groups, 4 or 5 year olds, working with kids. In the evenings, we would work with different teams, different areas, usually travelling teams more than anything. Again, varying abilities, all with a different philosophy, and we'd have to conform to that philosophy. And then in the summer, we would have select teams, they call them. So the best players that are at UK Elite, we get together. And we'd go and we'd live together at these private schools for a few weeks, get them up to scratch, and we're going into the tournaments around the country, which is very exciting.
I mean, it sounds like a great time, and in a time where you can kind of hone your craft and really learn about your own kind of coaching philosophies and styles.
Yeah, you will learn how to work with kids. Very different to working with first team, completely different environment. But I also did my American badges out there, did my NSCAA, got my regional, and then got my advanced diplomas as well. Again, slightly different to how the English do it. Again, interesting, some good, some bad, as there are in everything. But you develop as a coach, you develop how to speak to people, especially kids. Especially the more you do something, the better you get, don't you?
So, you know, and why you're here today at this conference is because you're one of the, if not the only, openly gay coach at that level
in
the game here in England. So let's talk a bit about that. When did you feel that it was right to share this information with your team, or were you open from day one?
No, it didn't really happen like that. I was 16 years old, I was at Camberley, I was already around the first, and we had a night out. I got very drunk, I had a boyfriend, and there's some girls in the corner, and they were like, come on, Tufts, they're looking at you, go and get in with them. And I literally, out of my face, showed them a picture of my boyfriend, and I remember being terrified, and I walked into training a couple of days later, and I was like a bit sheepish, and they were like, Tufts, Luke, did you try and tell us something the other day? I was, yeah. And they were like, that's all right. And then they were absolutely fine with it. So, and then because I was so young, I guess, as well, it got out into the world. They're quite protecting me because of my age, I think, as well as anything. And the world knew. I didn't really have to come out. Just wherever I've gone, people already know that I'm gay. So it's never really been an issue for me.
And I want to point something out with that. So when I... you know, I played abroad here in the UK, and then I started playing again in Atlanta, and I've never had this moment where, you know, I sat the team down and said, okay, everyone, I want you to know I'm gay, right? If they look at my social media, they'll know. I mean, I don't hide it, but I also don't feel as though I have to sit the team down, sit the managers, and say, I just want to let you know I'm gay. You know, they don't do that for me and let them know their sexuality is heterosexual. So I feel that... you know, that was for you. I mean, I'm glad that at that age you were, you know, willing enough and strong enough to do that. But
I was drunk enough.
Well, drunk
more
enough
than anything.
But I mean, I love the transition that your teammates respected it and accepted it, and they moved on. And that's what I feel like it needs to be in this day and age, especially in football, that there are people like this. Okay, great. Are they good at what they do? Okay, it shouldn't matter if they're gay, straight, whatever. So, I don't know, I applaud that from your teammates, and applaud what you're doing now. So you also play for the London Titans.
Yeah.
So can you speak to who the London Titans are and playing with them?
Oh, so London Titans are an LGBT friendly football team. So I joined them many a moon ago now when I was a teenager. And it's effectively just a normal football team that are full of players that just happen to be gay. So in America, you've got teams as well. You've got the New York Ramblers and you've got San Francisco Spikes. They're friends of ours. And I've got many friends in America that play for them as well, that we've met up with through tournaments, and we've kept in contact. So you have got these teams as well. Titans, we started by just playing in the GFSM, which is Gay Football Supporters Network League, against other gay teams. We were quite successful, and we won a few leagues in a row, And we then decided to make the jump into mainstream Sunday football. Started playing straight teams. The first year was a bit of a shock. Like, they spat on me, threatened to stab me, all sorts of things. Like, it was unbelievable. But we actually beat that team because they were more worried about us being gay than actually trying to play us. So they did themselves over there. Had to go home to tell their girlfriends they lost to a bunch of gays. So well done them. So that was a good day. But over time, again, it's just been... everyone being able to see you, it changes. People are scared of what they don't know. Once they get to know you and see you no different, they're okay. Titans is a fantastic space. I'm a very confident person. I'm very comfortable with the fact that I'm gay, and there's generally nothing anyone could say that would offend me, just being honest. But looking back, I think the main reason for that is Titans. So as a teenager, there was no way I was this confident. Like I said, I was a sheepish little boy going into the dressing room like, oh, I told you I was gay, I'm scared. But now... It was fine because 18, 19 years old, joined Titans, suddenly I'm around, at the time, 20, 30, now 40, 50, maybe even 60, gay people that just happen to love football, people that love football happen to be gay, and it makes you confident because you're saying, actually, I'm not different, I'm exactly the same, we're all the same, look at all these people that are exactly the same as me, that like the same things as I like, and people were talking about what's the need for a gay team. So there's two parts. That's originally, and still to an extent now, there are people that don't feel comfortable playing in the mainstream game for this reason or that, of which there are copious reasons and everyone has their own experiences. But even when those days go and you can be fully comfortable with yourself, I still will play for Titans because it's my community. I'd rather, like a lot of pub teams, that you go out drinking with people that go to the same pub with you. It's the same thing. Like, I want to go out in Soho on the night out. Titans go out to Soho. Like, it's a great... It's like a whole made family for you that like the same things, have the same sense of humour. It's a great place to be.
Are you guys in the Trinity League now, or are you still...
Trinity League? Do you mean London Unity League?
Yes, that's what I meant.
London Unity League. Yeah, we're still in that. We've got two teams in the Unity League. We've got one in the GFSN, and we've got one that plays in the Middlesex County League, which is like our top team.
Yeah, awesome. So I've been to a few tournaments with the Minnesota Grey Ducks, and I don't feel like we've ever drawn you guys as of recent, but maybe one day we'll be across from each other. I want to talk about earlier, we were talking about visibility, and that's really one of the big avenues we think to change this perception of homophobia in football, and rightly so. As you said, you know, as you were, the London Titans were playing other teams, they saw that you're just a normal guy, loves football, loves to go out, have a night out, you're just gay, and you're really not that different. And can you talk about what you think, how visibility can improve the issues we're having with homophobia in football?
I guess it helps in a number of different ways. I think, firstly, people are scared of what they don't know. So, same as when Titans joined, I think it was the same for Stonewall. So I can't speak for them, but from what I've heard people talk, in the early 90s when they started out, they had a lot of homophobia. But it changed over the years, and people stopped caring because they were used to that. They were used to Stonewall being there. Same with Titans. From what I've heard, that they get very, if any, homophobic abuse or comments during games now. I think they had one the other day. I know it's one too many, but in the great scheme of things, it's nothing like it used to be. The more people were visible, the more natural it is to them, and that's when they start. The ice breaks. Also helps because you get younger gay people that happen to be gay and love football, that they see there are people like them, and so they come out earlier, and again that increases visibility. So it's a cycle, and numbers of people that are comfortable saying they're gay in any sport will proliferate, and times will get better for everyone.
And I think also something you highlighted on, I mean, I think we all would love for us to, you know, snap our fingers and it be different, but it's a process, and you said it's a cycle. It's not going to change overnight. But I think as slowly as we continue to show, you know, be more visible, do programs like we're doing today, Titans continue to play and maybe do friendlies against other heterosexual teams, it will slowly begin to change.
Absolutely.
So we're going to talk about, it's a topic that a lot of debate is around, good and bad. We're going to talk about banter. I love banter. And we were talking about earlier, banter is what brings a team together, and it's about camaraderie. Some people think it's very negative or only look at the negative side of it. Let's first talk about this for people in the States who don't really know what banter is. I guess
is it a British thing?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't really.
I don't think we would say in the locker rooms at uni in US. I don't think we call it banter.
I really don't think so.
I don't know. I mean, it's.
Do you say the same things we say?
Probably not, and that's probably why we don't call it banter. I mean, we do pick fun at each other, but...
Oh, we destroy each other. We're ruthless.
I don't think we call it banter. I think it's really just a very British thing. Yeah, I think it really is.
Banter's just when you poke fun at each other, but in a friendly way, I guess.
Yeah.
And you'll find in the more successful dressing rooms that are closer together, there's nothing off limits. Like, if you play for a team, and you're together all the time, especially if you're, like... at a relative level of the game, you're with each other all the time, and you're going out to war with each other. And effectively, in dressing room, you need a real camaraderie. And the second you can't say this or can't say that, it has a bit of a negative effect. I think, like, obviously you don't want to bully. If there's something you clearly can't say because it's clearly going to upset someone, obviously don't say it. But as long as it's equal and everyone gets the equal amount of stick as each other. And there's a lot of it flying around. It's a very healthy place, and it's very much inside. Everyone will say what they want to you, but outside they're going to defend you, and that's kind of our team mentality over here.
Yeah, I mean, I had like one or two, I would say, bad experiences with banter, but it wasn't directly pointed at me. It was maybe something someone had said about someone else or someone else within the club, and I thought, oof, you know. What if they knew I was gay and they were saying that? But never did, and again, I wasn't out, but you know, I agree with you, like banter is really important. It builds that camaraderie. And then, as a coach, you've got to love it, as you said, because when your team is winning, that's part of that winning mentality, right?
Yeah, win, draw, lose, you got to, well, I guess we also have, what do they call it? Is it trench humour? They call it gallows humour, that's the one. We poke fun at ourselves.
Yeah.
That's what we do. You've got to have a thick skin. Of course, there is a line that does become bullying, but the difference between bullying and banter, in my opinion, is bullying is when it's directed at one person, or one person gets it more than anyone else. That's when it becomes bullying. It's banter if everyone gets equal amounts, and I think that's quite healthy. Oh, that's our perspective. And if you want to succeed in sport, if I've got young players that struggle with it, and they come up to me maybe in the academy and they say, yeah, this is happening X, Y, and Z, my job's to know what goes on anyway. But then you quickly identify, is it bullying? Are they getting more stick than anyone else? And is it unfair? And if so, then you put a stop to it. But if it's quite simply that actually, do you know what, they're being a little bit, I was saying in a nice way, are they being a little bit soft? Then I teach them coping mechanisms. And the best thing you can possibly do is to laugh at yourself. And then that soon negates any problems you get.
I mean, I love hearing it from your aspect as a coach, because you're in that environment when, like you said, you've got to identify, is it too far? And how do I handle someone who doesn't respond well to it? So I think it's super interesting to hear, like, your opinion on banter versus mine versus someone else's. So I really appreciate it earlier today when you were speaking of it, and now. You're speaking of it. So 5 years from now, you want to be a first team manager at this level? Kind of, what are your sights set out?
Not necessarily. I would want to manage one day, quite possibly. It's not my ambition right now. My ambition is to coach at the highest level I can. Obviously, managers have to deal with the money side and all that sort of thing, which I've got my hands muddy a little bit with that side of things. Now I've had to do the budget and do this and do that. But I just want to be out in the grass.
Yeah.
I just love setting up a team to win a game of football, and that's what I think that my talent is, and that's what I want to do. And I want to hopefully get to the Football League, and then one day in 10, 15 years' time, then, yeah, or late 30s or in my 40s, maybe that's time to manage.
Any last words on what you think should be done to improve homophobia in football?
I don't think there is. I think we do, everyone's doing a great job. The FA do a great job. PFA does a great job. Supporters groups are getting there. I think it will just naturally evolve. I think younger people don't really care anymore. Obviously, this society has got a long way to go. But football reflects society. And as more society embraces differences and that, so will football crowds and the older people. It's all very well saying education. It's harder to educate older people. And because obviously, how can you tell a 50, 60, 70-year-old that what they believe for 50, 60, 70 years is wrong? So when they will obviously change and evolve in time. Although obviously they'll be dead one day. I don't mean to say it, but yeah. It's true. And one day, and they'll be replaced with a younger generation that is a lot more accepting. Well, that's the theory.
Luke, I want to thank you so much for your time. Would you like to go ahead and share your social media with the listeners?
Okay, my Twitter is @LukeTufts. My same as my Instagram and my Facebook.
And if they want to follow your club?
At Hartley FC. So my football club's Hartley Whitney FC. So at Hartley FC. And yeah, give us a follow.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time. Happy?
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Hey guys, so I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Luke. Like I said, he's got great energy, a great buzz about him. He was very animated throughout the podcast. I can tell he doesn't like to sit still, but again, he brings a lot of good points up in the podcast, and again, I just really liked chatting with him. As always, I want to thank you guys so much for listening. As I said, you guys are what drives this podcast, and without you guys, there really wouldn't be a podcast like this out there. So again, thank you for your support. Thanks for reaching out to me, and thanks for tuning in for each and every episode. Do me a favor and hit that like, hit that subscribe button on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. I want to make sure you're getting updates on every episode that comes, and make sure you're in the loop with everything that's going on. And speaking of that, we're on all social media platforms, so please give us a like and give us a follow on our multiple platforms. We are on Twitter at TGFpod. We're on Instagram at TGFootballersPodcast. Our email address is TGFootballersPodcast@gmail.com. And we're also on Facebook at The Gay Footballers Podcast. As always, thank you guys so much for giving me a part of your day. I really and truly appreciate it. I'm going to add a little end note to the end of this one. I've got a good friend who does another podcast pretty similar to mine, but he covers a wide range of sports. And he actually interviewed Luke after the transition to NatPill FC. So his interview with Luke may be a little more up to date. If you'd like to check out the Level Playing Field podcast, it's a great podcast. And again, he's got a little more up to date interview with Luke. I interviewed Luke back in February, so you can hear more about Luke's time with NatPill FC if you check out Level Playing Field podcast. But again, thank you guys so much for giving me part of your day, giving me some of your time, and I hope to hear from you soon. Cheers.